Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to be in conversation about the beginnings of civilization. And we're talking about Sumer in which modern-day southern Iraq, classical Greece, early Egypt, the Qin dynasty in China, the Mayans in Central America. But in doing this, we're also going to be talking about the history of the people of these times that weren't a part of civilizations. People we would call today, for a lack of a better word, barbarians. In fact, by far, the vast majority of the world's population of the ancient world were outside of these civilizations, even while the dominant narrative of history today comes from this very small portion of people that actually lived in cities. So we're going to talk about all of this. We're going to talk about the creation of the state and also how states fall in the ancient world. My guest is renowned political scientist and anthropologist James C. Scott. James C. Scott is a Sterling Professor of Political Science and co-director of the Agrarian Studies Program at Yale University. He's the author of a number of influential books, including his latest, which is called Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States. James C. Scott, is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station.
Happy to be here. It's a pleasure and a privilege.
Well, the privilege is ours. And I have to say, your book was challenging for me. And I say challenging in the good way, because it really forced me to rethink my understanding of the ancient world and the rise of these ancient civilizations. And I'm no expert on this topic, but I am an enthusiast of it. And what I always thought, and we'll take Sumer as an example, 5,000 years ago in modern day Iraq, oftentimes considered the first civilization, that the rise of Sumer corresponded with the development of agriculture. And so people became sedentary and stayed place and ultimately became better off than, say, nomadic hunter and gatherer type of existence. And that inevitably civilization continues to progress for the betterment of at least most of the people. That's not the story you're telling.
No, in fact, that was the story I used to tell. I have been giving lectures at the beginning of a seminar on the comparative studies of agrarian societies for a long time on the domestication of plants and the earliest states, and what you just described as the process of civilization and sedentarization was the story that I had told. I was aware, and I had revised it a bit over time, that it was a bit out of date, and I got asked to give a couple of lectures and decided I would do these lectures, and perhaps what I might throw myself at is the literature that we have accumulated in the last two decades or more. And on that basis, I would then revise those lectures. It turned out that the lectures I had been giving were so wrong that I ended up taking a kind of three-year detour through this literature and trying to write up what I now understood from this literature and to report, in a sense, all the things that I had wrong, and I imagine lots of other people had wrong too.
So is this based on new scholarship that's sort of turning this whole notion on its head? And is it widely accepted?
Yes, actually, I'm very careful in this book. I report on those things that are settled knowledge, and on those things that are still in dispute, and there are many things that are still in dispute, for example, what drove people into agriculture as opposed to hunting and gathering, I report on the disputes. So I am simply conveying what we now know, and for those areas that are still in dispute, I report the dispute itself.
All right, so let's get into the story that you're telling here. And I guess, again, we've always thought of the beginning of agriculture corresponding and even causing the rise of the first civilizations. But there's actually evidence of agriculture and also sedentary life even before the rise of the state.
That's actually the starting point, and that's the big news, if you like. I think the standard narrative that we all learned was that when we managed to domesticate the grains, in this case wheat and barley, we could finally settle down, and this was the basis of the first sedentary communities. And then from there on, you had the division of labor and the creation of kingdoms and states and so on. It turns out that We have firm evidence of domesticated plants 4,000 years before anything like communities that are basically growing their subsistence crops in agriculture appear. So the idea that this invention would have immediately led to sedentarized agricultural communities turns out to be wrong. And 4,000 years is a long time for an innovation, if you like, to be left unexploited. And so that, in a sense, was the opening surprise for me and the thing that had to be explained.
What leads, then, in your argument, to the creation of a state? And I guess let's begin. I have a book at home. It says Civilization Begins in Sumer. That's the title of it.
Right.
Let's go there, Sumer, which is...
Well, the book, I should say, is mostly about Sumer or Mesopotamia. And the reason for that is that that's where the first states appeared. And they're states that, if you like, are not influenced by the existence of earlier states. So, for example, if I were to deal with Egypt, the fact is that Egypt borrowed a lot from Sumer and Mesopotamia. And the first thing I suppose that was really important for me to understand is that the area of the southern alluvium, or the southern floodplain, in Mesopotamia, today we think of this as, and it is in fact, an arid zone that's only available for agriculture with irrigation and canals and so on. And the fact is that 6000 BC, the water level was 300 feet above where it is today, the sort of worldwide ocean level. And as a result, the Persian Gulf extended far up into Mesopotamia than it does today, with the result that this whole area was a kind of wetland paradise of abundance of game and fish and birds and so on. So it was a kind of, and many people believe it was, the model for the original Garden of Eden, where hunters and gatherers and foragers could have a quite easy life, and you got communities of 1,000 or 2,000 people. So you had sedentarism, and you had people who knew how to grow crops, but very seldom grew much in the way of plants because the environment around them was so abundant, it made no sense for them to do the hard work that was involved in agriculture.
So how does Sumer then begin?
Oh, that's a question that's in dispute, and here I'm going to report on the dispute. So the question is, since life was so easy, even today, by the way, for foragers and hunters and gatherers in areas of the world that are environmentally harsher than they were then, the hunters and gatherers spend roughly half their time reproducing subsistence, getting something to eat. So the idea that hunters and gatherers, even today, are, you know, one day away from starvation and eating hand to mouth is just not true. And in ancient Sumer, the area anyway, life was quite easy for them, about as abundant as one could imagine for hunters and gatherers. So the question is, in order to have a state, you have to compress grain production and population in a small area so that they can be taxed, so that they can be, their labor can be used, so that they can be controlled. And so the question is, how did people become compressed in a small number of areas such that it was possible to make states? And the reason for this are in dispute. Some people believe that it's the increase in population, where you had to simply get more out of a smaller amount of land and therefore had to work harder. Some people believe it was the loss of big game, let's say the gazelles and so on, that could be trapped very quickly in their migrations, sort of like the salmon in the Pacific Northwest historically. A very little amount of work would bring you a lot of protein. Other people feel that it was a more coercive process. There was climate change in which a dry and cold period forced people back to the major sources of water, and therefore they became more densely packed, and it was possible to build states around them. Those are three different theories, and I'm not being an archaeologist or a demographer, for that matter. I'm not qualified to decide among them, but so I'm just reporting. In any case, it did happen, and there were indisputably early states that arose in Ur and Uruk and Eridu that we have lots of evidence from.
I get the sense from going through your book, Against the Grain, and recognizing everything that you just said there and how you qualified it, I get the sense you tend toward to see the rise of these civilizations to be as much about power and control as anything. Am I wrong in that?
No, not at all. So the important thing that I learned in the course of simply reading the literature that we have is that the density of people and domesticated animals and crops was an extremely unhealthy environment. And I call this the grain manpower module. And the reason for this is that it provides the epidemiological conditions for almost all of the infectious diseases that humankind has suffered from since the rise of civilization. Things like mumps, measles, chickenpox, diphtheria, and so on are diseases that are diseases that depend on densely packed communities and a geometric logic of infection. The same is true, by the way, for the domesticated animals. Once they were crowded together, they suffered epidemics as well. And all of our infectious diseases are, for the most part, zoonotic diseases that move between domesticated animals and human beings. It's not as if these diseases existed before these large aggregations of people developed. They did not exist at all. They were the product of, if you like, civilization. They're called actually density-dependent diseases or community infections. It is very important to realize that the conditions of water and sewage and so on, these were extremely unhealthy places. And the problem of keeping people in and dealing with the rates of mortality were enormously important. Keep in mind that even Western European cities until, early 19th century at the earliest, never could grow except by bringing more people in from the countryside because there were just too many diseases circulating in the cities. And only when we got sewage and clean water did these cities begin to grow from their own population rather than just bringing in more people from the countryside.
And bringing more people in from the countryside is an important point here, because if we look at all of these civilizations from the past, the first ones, again, Sumer and Iraq, Greece, Egypt, the Maya in Central America, the one thing that all of these ancient civilizations have in common, and civilizations that would follow would all have in common, is slavery.
That's right, and that's extremely important. And as I see this, that is to say, the actual population of these cities, that is to say, the citizens, were subject to harsh taxation, conscription, and labor dues as well. But the problem was that both people were leaking away, sometimes in small numbers and sometimes after, let's say, an epidemic or a war. They would leave in great sort of hemorrhages of people. And the thing that was striking to me is that all of these ancient civilizations, the only way they could replenish their population was by capturing people. And so their wars were seldom wars of territory, but they were wars of capture in which the object of the war was to capture people and bring them back and settle them so that they could produce close to the walls of the small kingdoms.
We are in conversation with James C. Scott. James C. Scott is a Sterling Professor of Political Science and co-director of the Agrarian Studies Program at Yale University. And he's the author of the book, Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States. That is what we are in conversation about. Talk to me about the importance of wheat.
Well, that's it. That's the reason the double meaning of the title, Against the Grain, has the one of the meanings is, of course, that I am contradicting much of the narrative that schoolboys and schoolgirls learn about the rise of civilization. And the second reason for the title is because all of these early states depended on a taxable grain. In Sumer, it was wheat and barley. In Maya, it would have been maize, of course. And along the Yellow River in China, it would have been first millet. And later on the Yangtze River, it would be rice. So there are certain characteristics. All early states are grain states or cereal states. And the reason for this is that it's only such grains that can serve as an effective tax good. We're dealing with a period in which there's no currency, of course, or coinage. And this will sound rather silly, but it'll make sense in a moment. The great advantage of cereal and grains is that they grow above the ground. They all get ripe at the same time. If the army wants your grain, can come in when it's all ripe and grab it, or better yet, it waits till you have put it in the granary, and then it confiscates the contents of the granary. And it can be dried and stored and given out as rations and so on, so that all of these early states depended on one or two forms of grain that could be used, confiscated, and used as a tax good. Compare that, for example, to people who grow potatoes or tubers or cassava, manioc, and so on. That is to say, if you are growing roots and tubers and the government wants your products, it's going to have to dig them up tuber by tuber just the way you do, and then it has a cart full of tubers that will spoil fairly quickly and are not worth a great deal. So that it was striking for me to realize that all of the early states depended on a cereal grain. And I would add that in Southeast Asia, which is the focus of much of my historical work, people who left the grain centers, those were rice centers, would on purpose often grow roots and tubers so that they could not be taxed by the state.
Yeah. So again, these grains are a de facto currency because we don't have currency yet. And of course, they last quite a long time as well. I guess the potatoes and these other root-based crops, these would be the crops of the rebel, or I guess what we'll say, the barbarians. Tell me who the barbarians are.
Well, it turns out that cassava, manioc, which is the kind of classical root and tuber, it's called in Latin America farina de guerra. Because guerrillas rebelling against the state will plant it in many places in the forest and can go back and dig it up when it's ripe. Because it, although it ripens in a year, it can be safely left in the ground for another 2 years and be quite good to eat, satisfactory to eat. And so, yes, indeed, it's by and large, there are other forms of agriculture that are state evading, if I can use that term, so that one of the most common forms of agriculture is called shifting cultivation or slash and burn cultivation, in which people cut down a part of the forest, they burn it, that provides the ash and the fertilizer, and they plant crops for 3 or 4 years, and then they burn another little section of the forest. If there's a lot of land, it's quite sustainable over time. After 50 years, you can go back to the same place again. But the point is that such forms of agriculture are growing often 20, 30, or 40 different crops, some of which are root crops. The fields change over time, and the people move with the changes in fields over time. So It's a kind of agriculture that is mobile and shifting, and it's never been possible to form a state on top of such a population because there's no way to economically appropriate its surplus.
And barbarians, and the word barbarian, it gets a, and sometimes, in fact, I think your book's a bit of a defense of the barbarian. But it gets obviously a bad connotation these days. Barbarian's an ancient word. It goes back to ancient Greece. It was meant for people that weren't Greek. Barba, ba-ba-ba, or something like that was, you know, they would mimic how non-Greek people spoke, and hence the word barbarian came. But important to note, this is the majority of the people in the ancient world.
Correct. And in fact, the origin, which you're quite right, this sort of ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, was the Greek imitation of what Persian sounded like. What's interesting, of course, is the Persians were quite as civilized as the Greeks were. And so it did not refer to the Circassians and a lot of the people the Greeks took as slaves from other areas, but was applied to the strange sounds that the Persians made, even though they were, as I said, just as civilized as the Greeks. So what was interesting to me, and it should be of interest to anyone who reflects on museum exhibits of early civilizations, and that is that if you build in stone in a central place and leave a lot of artifacts, and therefore are the site of an archaeological dig, you then get pages in the history books, you get exhibitions in museums, and these are the glories of the early civilizations. If, on the other hand, you build in biodegradable materials like bamboo or wood or reeds, if you spread your trash widely and don't concentrate in great aggregations in one place, then you're kind of lost to history. And so, in a sense, you could say that all of our senses of civilization and the population of the classical world, we lose all of those people who don't provide the raw material for museum exhibits, and we lose as well all of the people later on who don't leave tablets. One of the reasons why I'm working in Mesopotamia, in addition to it being the first, is that they practiced cuneiform writing on clay tablets. And the clay tablets survive very nicely in many places, whereas the Egyptians, for example, wrote on papyrus, which was at least slightly biodegradable, and did not survive quite as well.
Speaking of cuneiform, am I remembering this correctly, that the symbol for a slave was a combination of a mountain and a woman?
Correct. And so it's worth keeping in mind that the towns that I'm dealing with, the Ur and Uruk, I think Uruk was supposed to have something like 45,000 people in it. So we're talking about something that's quite modest by contemporary standards. But then it was probably one of the largest cities in the world. And roughly 9,000 of those 45,000 were slaves. And as you say, the cuneiform symbol for slave was the combination of mountain and woman, which tells us pretty easily that these were captives taken from the Zagros Mountains nearby, who were then, by and large, weaving wool garments that were the major trade good that these early states used to trade with their neighbors.
Geography is important in this story. The mountain is important in this story, in the symbol of cuneiform, along with the woman that would make up the term for slave. You say that states, they don't go up hills.
That's true. Yes, I used to give a talk saying states can't climb hills, but it's not, of course, an accident that all of these early states are on floodplains. That is to say, areas where their periodic flooding leaves very nutritious silt, and where, because the land is flat and there's water nearby, easy to get around, you can actually cram a lot of people in contiguous fields growing crops of cereals. The dispersal that's required in the mountains makes a different kind of society, and one that is not easily amenable to state building. So that it's a slight exaggeration, because they're occasionally on trade routes. There are choke points where you get a state that doesn't have a big agricultural hinterland. But in general, all early states grow up on floodplains or alluvial soils where the nutrition is provided by periodic floods, and in which you have a soil that's easy to work. So in early Egypt, for example, the annual flooding of the Nile was made for an easy kind of agriculture. That is to say, you had the annual flood, and as the flood receded, it not only left a nutritious layer of silt that was good for the crops, but it killed all the competing vegetation in the course of the flood. And that as the water gradually receded back into the main channel of the Nile, it left, if you like, a perfectly plowed field and harrowed field in which you could just scatter seeds and grow without much work. So the first forms of agriculture were this lazy man's agriculture, if you like, because we don't want to have to work any more than we want to. We'd like to avoid work if we can. And that was the only form of agriculture that was vaguely competitive with hunting and gathering in an abundant wetland.
And people would escape to the hills, to the mountains, to these more difficult terrains. It makes me think of Mexico, actually, even today, where you still find so many indigenous people are up in mountains. And it makes me think of the Zapatistas, even in Chiapas, that are located in the jungle.
That's right. There's Carlos Aguirre Beltran, I'm trying to remember the name of the book, did a very interesting book 30, 40 years ago, in which he pinpointed all those areas where you find great concentrations of indigenous peoples in Central and South America. And his argument was that they were either in swamps or the hills or in some cases desert areas. The point being that these were areas where they could escape the attraction of, or they could escape states. And in fact, and this is quite relevant, and I use it in another work of mine, Pierre Clastres, a French anthropologist who worked in South America, he studied the Yanomamo, the Guarani, and the Siriono. These were people who were thought to be original Stone Age people who had never made the transition to agriculture. And his argument, which turns out to be true as near as we can tell, there's a lot more evidence now. His argument was that these were people who did know planting and agriculture and left agriculture because that made them vulnerable to the forced labor and disease that they associated with the early Spanish settlements. And they took up hunting and foraging in order to stay away from the state. So if you like, they became a quote unquote primitive people as a strategy to avoid being incorporated by the state.
You also say this dynamic was very much alive within the United States, and especially with swamps in the United States, that both Native Americans and African escaped slaves would escape to.
Yes, if you couldn't make it, I mean, if the mountains were, if you like, in the slave states, were Canada, because if you got to Canada, you were free, and that was the promised land, as it were. If you couldn't make it to Canada, you could escape to swamps in which the difficulty of tracking you down was so enormous that the slaveholders gave up. So, for example, in the Great Dismal Swamp on the Virginia-North Carolina border, there were something like 6,000 escaped slaves living there at the onset of the Civil War. In the Everglades, there were all, and the Okefenokee, there were also large, both slaves and Native Americans, actually, Cherokee and so on, who fled there. And many of these people had lived in these swamps because there are drier areas where you can actually plant crops. Many of these people, it is said, grew up in the Great Dismal Swamp, never having seen a white man. And the Louisa May Alcott, by the way, wrote a book on the Great Dismal Swamp called Dread. That's worth reading. She did that after Uncle Tom's Cabin. But yes, swamps are a runaway place for slaves and serfs, as well as mountains.
And it's always been that way.
I think so. Of course, you know, the great example of this in Sumer is, of course, the so-called Marsh Arabs. It was a huge population of Marsh Arabs who lived in really extensive swamps in southern Mesopotamia. And over maybe 2,000 years, people had been running away, failed rebels, people sought by the law, people who lost factional struggles, ex-slaves, and so on. And the Marsh Arabs were a kind of made-up group of people who had run away to the swamps over more than a millennium. Saddam Hussein drained those swamps, and those people are now beggars in Baghdad and Basra and so on.
And what does that say about the state? Why are people avoiding the state?
Well, I guess I'm the way I put it, just in a catchy way, is that we have a vision of these early civilizations as paradises of leisure and luxury, and that probably was true for maybe 20% of the population. If you were a scribe or official or a valued member of an artisanal class, your life was rather good, and you didn't have to produce, but you could consume. For much of the rest of the population, this was arduous agricultural labor, heavy taxation, the danger of disease and conscription, and also digging canals and so on for the state. So that is to say, this early state was not, if you like, the Danish welfare state. This was a kingdom devoted to extracting as much value as it could from its population. And it was often would extract so much because it didn't have a lot of intelligence. It was a sort of clumsy state. It would confiscate much of a harvest, and therefore people wouldn't have enough to eat, and unless they got rations, they would run away.
We are in conversation with James C. Scott, Sterling Professor of Political Science and co-director of the Agrarian Studies Program at Yale University, author of the book Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States. You mentioned some of these groups that were outside of the ancient civilizations or around Mesopotamia. One group that comes to mind that I see you list several times, you'll correct me if I'm geographically off at all, but is the Kurds. And I found that interesting because obviously there are still Kurds today.
Yes, well, I'm not sure I could give you a good account of who the ancestors of the Kurds were back 6,000 years ago. It's certainly true that in these early days there were nomadic pastoralists. And in Mesopotamia, the people who are feared in many of the documents that survive are the Amorites. And they're seen as a pastoral nomadic people who therefore are seen as a military threat. And there is a wall called Sulgi's Wall that between the Tigris and the Euphrates that some people represent as a wall against the Amorites. It doesn't, the evidence is pretty weak for this. And I'm inclined to believe that many walls, including what Owen Lattimore says about the famous walls of China, the Great Walls of China, is that they were important mostly for keeping in a tax-paying population rather than keeping out the barbarians. That is to say, they wanted the farmers who were producing value and taxes and conscriptable soldiers, they wanted them to stay back of the walls, and it was less keeping the barbarians out than keeping the farmers and taxpayers in.
Why do you, if life was preferable in the ancient world, being outside of the state than with inside the state, and most people were without outside of the state, why do you think it is then the state would eventually become the dominant form of in creating modern day society?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure I have a comprehensive answer for that. One thing that is important is that although these agrarian states had high rates of mortality, this mortality often is a mortality that took place after the childbearing years of women. And sedentary society and grain consumption have the effect of increasing fertility. The kinds of foods that you can make with grains make it possible to wean children earlier. So every bit of evidence that we have suggests that sedentary grain peoples have children at a much higher rate than people who are mobile, hunters and gatherers, for example. In general, this is a rough number, but hunters and gatherers have a child every 4 years. People in agricultural societies in those days had a child every 2 years. And so despite the fact that they were disease prone and there was a high rate of mortality, the fact is that the rate of fertility was so high in these areas that they outproduced demographically the barbarians at the periphery. Of course, some of these barbarians were captured, controlled, had their favorite places denied to them, and therefore took up agriculture and so on. The interesting thing, I guess I want to go back to this question of why people stay in the same place. And I think one of the things that surprised me about my own denseness was the idea, I think, that I absorbed was that after we domesticated plants, it made it possible for us to stay in the same place and that we couldn't wait to settle down and stay in the same place. And the fact is, I realized that getting people to settle down in the same place has been a kind of military operation, let's say, in the New World. The only reason many Native American peoples were settled in a permanent place full-time was after military defeat and the reservations and so on. And in the Third World, in colonial areas, when you have pastoral nomads and so on, and you try to forcibly settle them down, you have an armed conflict. So the idea that a sedentary life was prima facie the only life that people desired needs to be examined carefully.
Domestication through force, which I guess isn't so surprising.
Domestication of people, you mean?
Yeah. Yes. Well, even animals, right? I mean, right. There's a certain amount of force that you even apply.
Yeah. Yes, that's something that I allude to in the book that I think deserves to be developed further, and that is that domestication, and here the actual word domestication means taking control over the reproduction of a plant or animal. So a domesticated plant, we have shaped it by selection so that it serves our purposes, and it cannot survive in the wild. We have taken control over its reproduction. The same for domesticated animals. There are physiological changes. They cannot survive in the wild. Sheep, right? Most of them, anyway, can't survive in the wild. And so domestication is the control over the reproduction. And I would argue that these early states, with their slaving and the creation of the patriarchal family, took control over the reproduction of their own domesticated human beings, that is to say, especially the slaves, but also their citizens as well. And therefore, the control over women's reproduction was a very important part of the early state.
Getting back to disease, in studying ancient civilizations, oftentimes we'll run into a civilization where it was just suddenly it was gone. And we're not entirely sure while it was gone. It's quite possible that that was disease.
That's my guess. There's not as much evidence as I would like for that. It's not as if the scribes stayed around when there was an epidemic in order to record it until they themselves died. So it's not surprising that there's not a lot of evidence. What there is evidence for are a whole series of temples that are devoted to the effort to prevent epidemic diseases, amulets, incantations, incense, priests and priestesses who claim a special powers to prevent epidemics from happening. And we have also a series of practices so that, for example, when a Mesopotamian army came back from a campaign, it is said they had to stop several miles outside the city, remove all of their clothes and armor and burn everything, and then return to the city naked so that they did not bring disease. Armies were always seen as carriers of disease if they were coming back from another area. So there is evidence. And of course, when we begin to get written records around the time of, or later actually around the time of Christ and so on, the argument is made by some people that that's the time when the disease pools of Africa, the Mediterranean, and Asia all come together because of a growing trade, long-distance trade. And there you get the Justinian plague, the Antonine plague. You get plagues that are actually taking the lives of hundreds of thousands of people almost overnight. And I think what you have in these conglomerations of people in the early states is a kind of mini version of the same thing that, and everybody understood that when there's an epidemic, you better get out of there.
Do you take any lessons from the early formation of states and civilization for us today?
It's clear to me that the reason I undertook to write this book in part, aside from having given these lectures historically and wanting to make them more accurate on the basis of new evidence, is that it's clear that we have gotten ourselves into a ecological fix, right, known as the Anthropocene these days. And I was curious about how we came to develop this form of production, of population structure, of states. And all of those came into being around 6,000 years ago. And we essentially have lived as agrarian societies until the Industrial Revolution. So most of our, if you like, our civilized life, if you like, has been an agrarian life. And so I was interested in the way in which this form of living was a new and artificial ecology. That is to say, the accumulation of large numbers of human beings, domesticated animals, and states all on one terrain, almost always a floodplain. These became, if you like, the ecological modules on which all civilizations were raised. And they were extremely vulnerable. They're extremely vulnerable because of the epidemiology. The fact is, if you have a lot of plants of the same kind in fields, they are also vulnerable to crop diseases. The epidemiology works not just for human beings and not just for domesticated animals, but it works for crops as well. So these are this is an extremely fragile ecology. And now, of course, with vaccinations and antibiotics and so on, we think that we at least have held our own against these diseases. But the fact is that this ecological module known as the grain manpower state, as I call it, was a new thing in the world, and it was extremely vulnerable to environmental failure of one kind or another.
That makes me think that in the ancient world, you at least had somewhere to escape to.
Correct. Correct. There was runaway room, definitely. And of course, now the massive effects that we want to call the Anthropocene are a kind of global phenomenon rather than a local phenomenon. So I try to actually examine the way in which, of course, the early planters and early states could not have understood what they were doing to the environment because they had no prior experience. So they, in a sense, remain innocent and blameless. But, for example, these early settlements of any size had a tremendous need for wood, not just wood for building and so on, but wood for metallurgy, wood for pottery, for the kilns for pottery and so on. And the result was it's difficult to move wood long distances if you're moving it in large amounts. The only way to do it is to use a river. And so almost all of these areas would cut much of the forest upstream from them because, you know, you could then leave it on the bank. And when the spring floods came, all the wood could be floated down to the city. The Gilgamesh actually is a story of this, of the city gates of wood being floated down the river with Gilgamesh in charge, as it were. And so what happened, of course, was that the runoff of silt upstream was exacerbated by the deforestation that took place. And over time, it brought that silt down the river, changed the course of the river. And you have a lot of places that are flooded out by sudden floods that are a result of their own, if you like, deforestation. The other thing that they were vulnerable to is salinization. It turns out when you begin to get irrigation on any large scale, the salts remain in the soil. And over time, the salt remains, and it's the soil becomes so saline that it's hard to grow any crops. And that's one reason, by the way, that barley tended to replace wheat. Barley is more is less sensitive to salts in the soil than is wheat. And so over time, there were areas that you couldn't grow crops on at all, or the yields were lower, or you had to substitute barley for wheat.
James C. Scott has been our guest. Again, James C. Scott is the Sterling Professor of Political Science and co-director of the Agrarian Studies Program at Yale University. He is the author of the book that has joined us for this conversation called Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States. James Scott, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you greatly.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.